From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, finding the right cast for a TV show. Plus, Hilary Swank talks about launching a production company. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, we have seen now the demise of Judy McGrath as the head of MTV Networks, a job that she had held for many, many years. And to me, it's kind of, you know, an end of a major era.
McGrath leaves behind a great legacy, not just on MTV and with hit shows like Jersey Shore, but also Nickelodeon, Comedy Central. I mean, she's been in the job for a very long time. Highly influential, and I think has an incredible track record. And whether or not she left on her own free will or was pushed, I guess, open for debate.
Well, I think she was pushed to a large degree, and Jersey Shore is part of the problem. I mean, Judy McGrath was part of MTV when it was, you know, music, and considered that, I think, a really important brand. You know, I was talking to a source who's really familiar with all of this stuff that went on there. And the fact is, even though Judy McGrath was not just about MTV and music, and Nickelodeon was the big thing there from a business standpoint, and she had a lot to do with Comedy Central and building that into what it is now, this kind of pressure to come up with numbers and ratings and ad sales with shows like Jersey Shore, I'm not sure that's the sort of thing she signed on for. And you know, John, just this past week, the Electric Barbarellas debuted on MTV. This is a show about a rock band.
Sumner Redstone's favorite band,
Sumner
right?
Sumner Redstone's favorite band, a young lady that he seems to have had a close friendship with. It was in that show. That show was put on the schedule over the objections of MTV executives. And so this is really the subsuming of this kind of old guard way of doing business, you know, this kind of rock and roll culture and not playing strictly coloring within those business lines. Of course, MTV, the MTV networks are part of Viacom. Philippe Dumont, who is the CEO, the highest paid CEO, I believe, in the country, it will now have a much more hands-on role in running it. And, you know, these guys these days, they're about dollars and cents and bottom line. And the rock and roll era in the entertainment world is not what it used to be.
But at the same time, it looks like NBC is stepping up to really bolster its primetime lineup.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, pilot season has been well underway. The upfronts are coming up, and NBC is being watched with great interest with Bob Greenblatt from Showtime running it now. And, you know, like one of the shows that's really buzzed about is the show Smash that goes behind the scenes in the creating of a Broadway musical. This is something he brought with him from Showtime. People are hoping that while he can walk a commercial line, he's going to do kind of interesting, maybe sort of more cable-y shows.
I'm assuming Spider-Man is not the focus of the Smash show.
Now, that would be dramatic, yeah.
No, Steve Burke, who is NBC Universal's CEO, said that they're going to spend $200 million on the NBC primetime lineup and another $100 million on its cable channels. And the real issue is they have to fill their 10 o'clock holes. They're still trying to recover from their Jay Leno debacle, where they put him on for 4 months in 2009 and early 2010, which not only failed in absolute terms, but also kind of left a huge hole in NBC's 10 p.m. schedule. So it's not just a question of spending money. They've got to find hit shows that will fill that void. And Burke said, and again, who has never said this in Hollywood before, the key to turning around NBC is not necessarily increasing the investment. The real key is making better shows.
Well, they you know, it ain't easy. And boy, I actually say it's very rare for the town to feel that the town is rooting for somebody. But I feel like there are a lot of TV people rooting for Bob Greenblatt to pull NBC together and do something interesting. Meanwhile, on the movie side, another end of an era, as we were talking about with that MTV, the film department, no more.
This is a small independent production company that was started by Mark Gill, who is a veteran of Miramax films, and they never quite got going, and they tried an initial public offering a year ago that didn't take, and They're closing down this month, and they really only made three movies. Two of them haven't even come out, The Rebound with Catherine Zeta-Jones and a little bit of Heaven with Kate Hudson. But
the one that didn't worked, right?
Yeah, it kind of worked. That was 2009's Law Abiding Citizen with Jared Butler and Jamie Foxx. It grossed about $133 million worldwide, but they didn't keep all that money, and they paid pretty steep distribution fees domestically. So, I mean, this company would still be in business if they had some hit films. They blamed the credit crisis. They blamed their inability to get new capital. But like everything else, if they had some successful movies, they'd still be in business.
I do think some people feel, you know, a sort of sadness. Mark Gill has been just a fixture on the independent circuit for quite a while. And the idea that he can't make something like this work feels like, not good to a lot of people in that independent film world.
But these were very kind of middle brow, not awards movies. So it's not as if they were going back into the Miramax and Warner Independent Pictures, where Gill also worked space. They weren't making art films. They were making apparently really bad middle brow films.
One less buyer, but maybe not a reason for weeping in the indie film world then.
I guess the easy joke would be they aimed low and they missed.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can stay up to date with all the Hollywood news that's fit to banter on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. The success of a TV show involves many factors, but obviously a big one is the chemistry among the actors. You can have a great concept and a wonderful script, but if the casting doesn't work, you're done. If it does, you might have Seinfeld or House. As with a lot of decisions in Hollywood, many people weigh in when it's time to cast a television pilot, a process that has absorbed the industry in recent weeks. As we speak, all the broadcast networks are evaluating the fruits of their labors as they pick the shows that will make it onto their fall schedules. These are high-stakes wagers, and the big reveal comes next week in New York when the broadcast networks present their fall lineups to advertisers. With all these pilots in play, we decided to check in with two veteran casting executives to talk about how they do their jobs. Lori Opendon is head of casting for the CW, the smallest of the five broadcast networks. Previously, she was at NBC when that network was in its heyday. She worked on casting shows like Seinfeld, ER, and Friends. Marcia Shulman is winding up a long run as head of casting for the Fox Network, where she's worked on shows including House, Glee, and 24. She's about to step down, but she'll remain as a consultant working exclusively for Fox. It's not intentional that both of our guests are women, but in a business still dominated by men in many areas, women have always tended to be in charge of casting. I asked Lori Opendon why.
Well, there's different theories. I think originally many casting directors started off as what was called secretaries at the time, and they would have some good casting ideas and they were eventually promoted. You also, to be a casting director, you have to start as an assistant, and that seems to attract more women. And I think people,
an assistant to a casting person?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Like
now, in fact, you have to start as an intern. You can't even start as an assistant. You have to start as an intern. And I think a lot of people feel women are the nurturers and they have a good creative taste in actors, work well with people. And there's not a specific reason, but it does seem to include, I don't know what, 80% women, I would think, yeah, of casting directors.
I actually didn't start as an assistant, but through a series of events, I got very lucky, and it was just a career that I wanted to pursue, and I got a break. But I agree, Lori, about I think there's a big nurturing aspect to it. And I understand it, because somebody writes a script and doesn't know actors, and you're kind of giving your baby away, and you're in the dark.
So you're not nurturing the people coming into audition. You're nurturing the creative person behind the show.
That's the first person you have to nurture.
Yeah.
And then you go from there. I think casting directors are mostly advocates. They're advocates for the producers. They're advocates for talent. As an executive, I'm an advocate for my network. So it's all those things have to come together somehow.
Lori, you worked for a while independently and then became an executive. Is that correct?
Yes.
So what's the difference between independent and being an executive?
Every show on television has a casting director that is responsible for the cast on that show. The person at the network oversees and supervises all those casting directors that work on the different shows. The network executives have a lot of input on the cast. We don't actually hold the sessions, but we have a lot of input. We deal a lot with budgets. We deal a lot with guest stars and stunt casting. And ultimately, the network has the responsibility and privilege, I guess, to have the final okay on which actors are cast in pilots, which eventually become series.
You know, somebody once said to me, there's a casting director on a show, there's studio casting, and then there's you. So why do you need all those people?
Right.
And the answer is, it takes a village. It is very hard to cast, and people have... get input from all different places. Somebody goes out and sees a play or a movie. You're at dinner with an agent, or you've had a meeting with agents and they're telling you who's out there, who's looking for something. So there's information coming in from all different areas at all times, and it's taking an amalgam of all that information and just getting your shows cast.
And do you guys go out to clubs and look for like random people thinking, you know, if I ever need a middle-aged housewife, that woman from the Laugh Factory really, really is like Roseanne.
Yes. Yes. And I would say for myself, the joy of casting is discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go out and you see somebody and you know they're good. And I think the difference between casting people and the rest of the world is when I see somebody, my next thought is, what could I put them in? How could I use them? Whereas someone else will just say, oh, they're good. I'm enjoying this.
Right.
You know, finding someone is what casting is. Otherwise, people just pick who they wanted to be in their shows.
Well, I'll ask each of you. Do you have one where you felt like this was the one, this was my one, my Hall of Fame find, or a couple, Marcia?
You know, a big one for me, and I don't know if it falls into this category, but I was this huge fan of Hugh Laurie, and all I did was think about how is Hugh Laurie going to come to the network. And when I read the script for House, I went to Gail Berman, my boss, and I said, I know who it is. It's Hugh Laurie. And she said, he's Stuart Little. He's not House. And it's been documented. I mean, she was interviewed about it. And it's also well known that when Hugh finally did come in to read for it, I cried in the room because it was such an incredible marriage of actor to role.
Okay, so how did you know? I mean, here you see this guy. He's British, first of all. He's Stuart Little. What about that said to you, this is House?
I met him several years before. He had sent me a book that he wrote. I knew he was kind of a rock and roll guy, not this buttoned up guy. And I knew he was a great actor. And, you know, I think it's why I do what I do, to know occasionally, to occasionally know. Lots of times I don't.
Lori, do you have one?
My biggest one I can think of probably is when I worked at NBC, which I did for a very long time, and had the idea for Jennifer Aniston to do Friends. And we had her in other shows, and it was somebody we really felt strongly was going to pop. And when that role came around, I remember whispering to my boss, what about Jennifer Aniston?
And she had just been like popping up on sitcoms? What?
Yes, and yes. She had been in another show of ours called Ferris Bueller's Day Off. She played the sister. And we had cast a variety show that I believe went to Fox, and we had put her in that.
So you have this little mental file, and you're thinking, girl, attractive, you know, funny, I got to put her somewhere.
Yeah.
I know I
well,
can do something with her.
Well, attractive and funny, you don't forget those too often. Right. That's very hard to find.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about casting TV shows with Lori Opendon from the CW and Marcia Shulman from Fox. The process of casting a network TV show often starts with the showrunner and casting director narrowing their choices. Then the network weighs in and the top candidates audition. A few years ago, Fox decided to use videotaped auditions, and I asked Marcia Shulman why.
The actual network testing process is basically three actors are up for the same role. They sit staring at each other and they're signing contracts and they're doing all kinds of things. And then they have a minute to walk in and do a great audition and earn the role or not. And this seemed not a good way to do things after you spend months and months developing something and then you have a matter of seconds to cast it. So we started having a conversation about how we could do things differently. And out of that conversation came you know what? We should screen test. We should give actors their best shot at something and have the directors work with them and put something together. So now we leave it up to the individual studios and producers. And when they ask me, I say, do what you need to do to get someone a job. If you want to bring people in live, you feel that they're better that way, we're fine. If you want to do a screen test, we're fine with that too.
And then if you like the screen test, do they then have to follow up live to make sure that they didn't just do it 75 times and do the one that wasn't horrible?
Not usually. And, you know, we think on a set sometimes they're doing it 75 times. So, you know, it's okay.
I mean, with a guy like Hugh Laurie in house, would you have said to a Hugh Laurie, we're going to look at this tape, or would he have come in?
Well, Hugh actually was on a movie in Africa and put himself on tape. He was in a bathroom and put himself on tape, and that's what we got. And then when he finished the film, he came into the room live.
The bathroom tape was good enough to convince people to let him come into the film.
I knew I might hold on to my job for another couple of months after the bathroom tape, but once he came in the room, I felt a great sigh of relief.
Yeah. Now, and Laurie, when you do this, do you do the same thing or do you go for live?
No, we do live auditions that we put on tape. Mm-hmm. So my assistant is the camera person, and as the people audition in this little studio we have, we tape the auditions, but we're there live watching. And we like to do it that way so that we feel we have the best of both worlds. If an actor comes in and reads and they're off track, or one of our executives feel that the actor's taking the wrong direction, or we want to see something different, or we feel they were nervous and we want to try again, the actor will go out and we'll talk about it in the room, and then the director can go out and give the actor a few notes about how to do it differently, and they come back in. And then we never or rarely say to anybody they have the job in the room. We always watch the videotape afterwards. So we actually do both. We do live auditions that we put on tape.
And now, Marcia, you had a great quote in the New York Times talking about plastic surgery, mm-hmm. that it's harder to cast because people messing with their faces.
I'm a little bit old school, you know, going back to that quote, they had faces then. What I find uninteresting is this sameness to people where everybody looks the same, whether it's through the hairstyle or surgery or Botox or clothing. And I really tend to respond to uniqueness in people. And I understand that people should be attractive or, you know, whatever that is. But I'm much more interested in charisma and uniqueness. Mm. It, certainly my personal eye is.
That you find that the network is not?
Fox is pretty good about having, you know, we have Tim Roth as a lead in the show. We have Hugh Laurie as a lead in the show. We just did a pilot with Lauren Ambrose is the lead, and Janet McTeer, who's an incredible stage actress. And they are just fantastic actresses and beautiful in their own way, but in a non-traditional Hollywood way.
Laurie's like CW has a younger... I mean, do you have a particular look? You think, this is a CW look. This guy has that.
I think the agents actually have it more than I do because they'll call me and say, oh, this is a CW actor. To me, a CW actor is young and talented and attractive.
And that coincidentally comes, gorgeous.
Yeah, or that comes third or something. But because they are younger, I don't worry a lot about, altering their looks.
Coming up after a short break, why so few American men are cast as leads in TV dramas. And Hilary Swank in the producer's chair. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with two network casting executives, Laurie Opendan of the CW and Marcia Shulman of Fox, about what goes into getting the right cast for a TV show. A couple of months ago, when The Chicago Code premiered on Fox, we spoke with creator Sean Ryan, who shared his frustration that these days it's nearly impossible to find an American man to cast as the lead in a drama. Instead, showrunners turn to Australians or Brits. Marcia Shulman, who cast the British Hugh Laurie in House, agrees with Ryan that there's a scarcity of American men who can play the lead in most TV dramas.
I don't know what happened to the Clint Eastwoods and the Robert Mitchums of the world and people like that, but I also think there's stylistic things that happened over historical times, like in the 40s, there was one kind of guy. And then in the 70s, there was De Niro, Pacino, Dustin Hoffman kind of guy. And I think there's a real boyishness to our leading men right now. Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt, and they're even on the older side of it. And so I think you have to dig for those old-fashioned real men.
And Lori, you have, do you find that the CW just has a different version of guy?
No, I think we want what you guys want, but younger. And we had this pilot season. We hired several Australian and British actors this year, all doing American accents. I think some of the men, too, that we are interested in are doing features. If Matthew McConaughey would do television, we'd have shows for him, but he's doing features. And so I think that's part of the problem. We split some of these talented people with features. And
well, then they circle back, right? Marcia, you've got Ethan Hawke in a pilot this year.
I think actors are looking for good writing and good people to work with, and it's not so much on the feature side anymore. I feel I came at a very good time in terms of television not being such a second-class place to work. I think a lot of people are coming to television. Everyone's coming to television. And yes, movies are competition for us, and also for us, the cable schedule is competition. There are people that want to come to television, but they only want to do 13 episodes a year. They want to hold out for that. Or there's certain language that can be said on cable that you can't say on broadcast television, so they feel maybe the roles can be executed in a more authentic way. But I think across the board, writers, directors, producers, talent, people are coming to television. We ask anybody now.
Thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you. This was
fun.
Marcia Shulman is the outgoing head of casting at Fox. Lori Opendan is the head of casting at the CW. It's hardly a secret that many, maybe most, big female stars fade as they age. Hollywood simply doesn't tend to crank out that many great roles for actresses cruising past 40. Hilary Swank isn't there yet, and she's been working a lot, but she isn't putting all her eggs into the acting basket. As you undoubtedly know, Swank won Oscars for Boys Don't Cry and Million Dollar Baby. She was nominated most recently for her role in Conviction. But she's hit some rough patches at the box office lately, notably with Amelia, the 2009 film about the famed lost aviator. But in the past couple of years, Swank has also ventured into producing. She's one of the S's in a company called 2S Films. The other S in 2S is Molly Smith, the daughter of billionaire Fred Smith, who's the founder and CEO of FedEx. Molly Smith was formerly an executive at Alcon Entertainment, the company funded by her father, and she was an executive producer on The Blind Side, which was Alcon's first big hit. 2S has a first look deal with Alcon. Swank and Smith are our guests today to talk about the partnership between an accomplished actress and a young producer with access to funding. Fame and fortune surely help, but Swank and Smith will need to make movies that people want to see. The first test is Something Borrowed, a romantic comedy starring Kate Hudson, Jennifer Goodwin, and John Krasinski.
I get it. You're in a tough spot because you love him. But you got to do something about it, Rachel, because he's being a total coward. And if he breaks your heart, I'm going to take a swing at him. And then I'm probably going to let him beat me up.
I got to go to work. I'm late.
I know, Rachel. That's the point. Be late. Better yet, quit. At least there would be a decision.
Swank doesn't appear in Something Borrowed, and she says she didn't go into her partnership with Smith to create acting vehicles for herself. But I asked her if she's moving into producing in part because the cliche is true, and even a few years shy of 40, she's already finding fewer good roles out there.
Thankfully, not yet. You know, I'm still, I guess, young enough that I haven't been feeling the brunt of that. I'm certainly, you know, you hear about it.
You see it.
And you do see it, although, you know, you also see a lot of more roles, I think, opening up for older women. Meryl Streep seems to be dominating.
Well, but she's almost like the exception, you know. I mean, when you're really a character, she's not like a pretty girl, and you're not either, so that's...
Hey, what are you saying?
No, I don't
I'm
mean...
just kidding, I'm kidding, I'm kidding.
That didn't come out wrong, though. Sorry.
Actually, I completely know what you're saying. I mean, I play characters.
Right.
I don't play a movie star-looking type of person, which
right.
I prefer. I mean, who walks around looking like that anyway?
So where were you, Molly, when you met Hillary? You were on a movie, right?
Yes. Actually, the very first film I worked on as a production assistant was in Prague in the Czech Republic, and I was getting Hillary's... I think you were off coffee at the time drinking green tea. tea, if I remember. Only tea. So that was the first film I worked on.
That and was The Necklace.
The Affair of the Necklace.
Thank you.
The Marie Antoinette story. And the production for that was really tough. And therefore, of course, one of the greatest learning experiences for a production assistant is when a film is incredibly tough just to watch and learn.
So you're, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, you're like the rich kid. Your father is like a big magnate. Did you go on to that movie thinking, I have to keep my head down? Because especially in Hollywood, all the sharks look at you and think, yum, yum, yum.
Sure, there's always pressure of working with my father's company and being my father's daughter. But I think it just, if anything, it just inspires me to work that much harder to prove yourself. And, you know, we grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and my mom loves Walmart more than any person I know. So,
right. You know, and also I've been in the business over half my life now, and your name doesn't get you that far. It
well,
just
but
doesn't.
No, but a name backed up with a lot of money does.
It doesn't. If people wanted the money, they'd just go to Fred Smith himself and say, hey, you know, we want to make this movie or whatever. They don't have to go, you know, through Molly, but Molly's proven herself as a legitimate producer who people want to know.
You brought in The Blind Side, right, Molly?
Correct. We grew up down the street from the family, so I was familiar with the story.
Right there, you could like make like 50 bad movies in a row now, right, and saying that I did The Blind Side. So. Does your dad have any participation in what Alcon greenlights, or does he leave that to those?
He does. Absolutely, yeah. No, it's a
he reads scripts?
He reads scripts. He actually does really enjoy the creative collaboration part. And you know, really, he's a sort of end result guy. He's like, well, what do you think this story is about at its core? And what do you think about it both from a business sense and a creative sense? And it's definitely become a passion of his over the years as he's learned more about the business. Now, he still thinks the economics of the movie business are crummy. But
he's the one who's in it.
But that point of view, you know, is always important for us as producers as we grow and learn. You know, it's not just a creative experience.
So how would you define a 2S film?
You know, the movies that we're producing are definitely vehicles for women. I mean, we're being women, obviously, those are the stories that we relate to, and those are the stories that we want to tell, and we want them to be stories with women in them.
You know, I would say a 2S film, it's just going to have a lot of heart and be very emotionally moving, whether that's, you know, in a comedic tone, in a dramatic tone. I mean, you know, a little bit of both, which is our favorite combo.
Does the phrase chick flick have a bad connotation for you guys?
You know, we were asked that the other day, and I think the only reason people think of it as a negative term is that it may seem eye-rolling for a guy to be dragged to it.
Exactly.
I think, if anything, it's just something that women love and enjoy.
Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us.
Hilary Swank is the Oscar-winning actress of movies like Million Dollar Baby. Molly Smith is a producer of films like The Blind Side. Swank and Smith are producing partners. Their first film together is Something Borrowed. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. To leave a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness or go to our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. You can listen to us online at kcrw.com or on your phone with the KCRW iPhone and Android apps. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.